All right, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to panel number 3406, is April 12 at noon. That's for the tape, guys. This is Torture, Human Rights and Wrongs. I'm Chris Allen, I'll be your moderator today. We have two wonderful speakers who will kind of lay down their wisdom, but what we're really after is a good discussion conversation after that. If you've been to one of these before, we won't be doing the usual pick the question out of the crowd thing. If you do have questions, we've got index cards, put your hand up, and our lovely, youthful producers will come and bring them to you, write them down, and then we'll get to questions and discussion at the end. Okay? So our two panelists, right at my left, Janet Breslin Smith. When I asked her what was the last thing that surprised her, she typically didn't answer the question, she answered the other one. What didn't surprise her, she wasn't surprised that Trump won. And in fact, made $200 off it, so I think she's playing the drinks tonight. And to her left, Mark Fallon. His biggest surprise in the last couple of years, he said he was inspired by the patriotism when the Senate Intelligence Committee, in a bipartisan way, fought to release the torture report, the executive summary. So without further ado, let's get to it. We're going to start off with Mark. He's going to kind of lay down a foundation for us, and then we'll talk about 10 minutes, and then we'll shift over to Susan, and I'll give you a spitball or something about an empty bucket, okay? All right, thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thank you everyone for being here. When I look in this room, I'm not sure everyone remembers September 11th. You might remember images of it, but you were probably very young at that time. So I'm going to tell you what happened and what I was doing on September 11th, and I'm going to kind of set a foundation, historically, for how we enacted a national policy of state-sponsored torture, and that's what we did. So on September 11th, I was in London, England. I was sent there by the Director of Counterintelligence for the Department of Defense to brief the NATO Defense Ministers Conference on the dangers of terrorism. At the time, I was the Chief of Counterintelligence Operations for the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, and I was the commander of the USS Cole Task Force investigating Al-Qaeda's attack on the USS Cole on the 12th of October 2000. Almost 3,000 people were killed on September 11th. It was a despicable act that really rocked this country. I'm going to talk about kind of what happened after that and kind of the actions that our government took that resulted in that national state-sponsored torture policy. So on September 14th, President Bush issued a national state of emergency. What that state of emergency did, granted the president unique constitutional powers. He granted those to himself. And the Constitution actually allows for that in times where it looks like the country is going to be invaded. And so they were anticipating another wave of attacks. The rule of habeas corpus was one of those things that he overruled in that. He said that I have the power or authority to actually incarcerate someone without trial. And that was rather unique, because that was part of the Magna Carta that the rule of habeas corpus came from. So let's move forward again a few days, September 17th. That was a very unique day in our history as well, many people don't know about. On that day, the president issued what's called a memorandum of notification, or some people call it a finding. And that memorandum of notification gave the Central Intelligence Agency the authority to create what's called the RDI program, Rendition, Detention, and Interrogation Program. None of those things were core competencies of the Central Intelligence Agency. They are a spy agency. I know on television they interrogate people, but up to September 11th, that is not a core competency of that organization. And so with that RDI program, they established what was called EIT. Anybody know what EIT stands for? No one's going to answer. Well, what the CIA says it stands for is Enhanced Interrogation Techniques. What Mark Fallon says it stands for is Excuses to Inflict Torture. And that's what it was. And so that was on September 17th. On November 13th, President Bush issued a military order. Military order said that the president has the authority to detain and try before military commissions anyone who is or was a member of Al-Qaeda, anyone who aided, abetted, or knowingly harbored the Al-Qaeda terrorist network. And that military order went to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and that order went up on my lap. And I was responsible for executing that order, and I was the chief investigator and special agent in charge of a task force that was responsible for bringing al-Qaeda terrorists to justice for military convictions. So I was pretty deeply involved in this stuff, as you can see. On January 11th, the first prisoners arrived at Guantanamo Bay. That was a little while before this recent thing, but I was shocked and surprised that we really did get a number of high-ranking al-Qaeda operatives. We got people that we called dirt farmers. We had people that we paid rent, a tort we paid bounty for, and we didn't get what I was told would be the worst of the worst, who I was looking for and anticipating. We got people that we paid money for, and we got a lot of the wrong people. On February 7, 2002, President Bush declared that the Geneva Conventions did not apply to terrorists. Now, the Geneva Conventions were enacted to protect our military members from being tortured, and the U.S. is the one who really pushed for that after World War II. So with these new policies, what we did is we became a state sponsor of torture. Now, Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution is the one that talks about habeas corpus, and I won't go into a lot of detail, but I will tell you what Alexander Hamilton said, one of our founding fathers. He said, habeas protects us against the most favored and formidable instruments of tyranny. Thomas Jefferson said, habeas protections guided our steps through the age of revolution and reformation. So historically, we were a nation founded upon human rights. And so that was inculcated in our founding fathers when they wrote the Constitution. What the U.S. did is they began to utilize the same type of practices that we rebelled against in the revolution, with the unlawful detention and arbitrary incarceration of people without right to trial. What was interesting, and I found historically, I said that no one remembers that day on September 17th that they issued that order. But let me get this right. 214 years earlier on that day, in 1787, was when the Constitution was signed. Independence Hall in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, with George Washington's signature on the top of that document. When we declared independence in July 4th, 1776, George Washington did not sign that Declaration of Independence, not because he didn't want to, because he was the Commander-in-Chief of the Northern Expeditionary Forces of the Continental Army, and he was in Manhattan waiting for the invading forces of the British soldiers. So he was unable to sign that declaration. But what he did is, he sat on September 14th in his encampment in Cambridge, Massachusetts, waiting for his army to invade Canada, to attack the British. And what he did at that point is he issued a military order. He wrote a letter to his top operational colonel, a guy named Benedict Arnold. And I'm going to read a little bit from that letter. Because from his encampment at Cambridge on September 14, 1775, George Washington said, "While contending our own liberty, we should be cautious of violating the rights of others. I beg you to inculcate upon your officers and soldiers the necessity of preserving the strictest order during the march through Canada. Should any soldier be so base and infamous as to plunder or insult persons or property, bring him to severe punishment as the crime may require, including death. Such behavior represents shame, disgrace, and ruin to themselves and to our country." Commander-in-Chief Washington signed that letter 226 years to the day that President Bush declared that state of emergency, granting him the powers of honor. So the legal cover for torture was based on contention that torture was necessary, was effective, and was safe. It was none of those things. Torture isn't only ineffective, and it's counterproductive. Torture is illegal, it's immoral, it's ineffective, and it's inconsistent with American values. America is strongest when our values match our actions. Patriots do not torture. It's an act of cowardice. And George Washington anticipated it brought shame, disgrace, and ruin on torturers in our country. And that's what we did after September 11th. Thank you.
dogs are always fun to come out of Boulder. What I want to do is, because I look at this room and I know some of you were born in 2001. It's not right. When were you guys born? So, yeah, well, 2002. Okay. So that always makes old people go, oh my God, you know, what am I going to make reference to that you don't know what I'm talking about? What I want to do, so briefly, if you looked at my bio, I had an odd career. I went to school at USC, and then UCLA for my PhD, California person. Went back to Washington, ended up working at Capitol Hill for 17 years for a senator who was deeply involved in human rights. And so I was Senator Patrick Leahy, and I did a lot of stuff in Latin America and Central America on that topic. And then later on, I taught the National War College for a long time, working with military officers and diplomats to how you think about war and how you conduct war, what are the laws of war. So these issues have kind of been with me professionally, but on a personal level, I lived in Santiago, Chile in 1973, and I'm going to talk about that. And then I'm also probably at the end or in Q's and A's talk about the fact I also lived in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia for almost 5 years recently. In the first term of the Obama administration, my husband was U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia. So I had a chance to live for a long time. As long as you guys are going to be in college, I lived in Saudi Arabia. So I'm going to give you some reflections about these issues that we're talking about in the context of our country, but how to think about these questions, because these are profound human questions. So first I'm going to tell you about Chile, because you probably, I don't know, has anybody ever heard of Allende and Pinochet? Okay, let me just say a little bit of the story. Chile is a beautiful country in South America. It's a lot like California, only it's in the southern hemisphere. Mountains, ocean, if you ever get a chance to go, beautiful country. It reminded me of California. It had a Congress. It had an elected president. They had viable parties. They had high literacy rates. It was a country that, when I went down there, seemed very comfortable and familiar to me. It had a democratic system, three main parties. The man who had been elected was a man named Salvador Allende. He was a socialist. This happened in the 70s, so this is a time during the Cold War, you studied that, where we were in competition with the Soviet Union. So we were very attuned to a concern, would nations go for that side? Would they become socialists? Would they become communists? Would they become allies with the Soviet Union, which we saw as our opponent? Allende was elected. There was a strong support. He was a socialist. There was support for the Socialist Party in that country. There was also support for a very conservative party called the National Party. And there was a Christian Democracy Party kind of in the middle. I got down there, I was married to my first husband who had a Fulbright scholarship. I was newly married, I was 27 years old. This was like a big spring break idea for me, to live in a different culture. All through the years of Allende, there was turmoil, upheaval. There was a book written about what happened, but there was an undermining of his legitimacy that he did to himself and that other nations, including ours, participated in. And so at a certain point, the military felt it was necessary to intervene, to have a coup against this democratic elected government. It was a hero, a concern about communism and socialism and the land being given away to people, all types of economic concerns. I was living in Santiago that day. All of a sudden on the radio, you hear martial music, military music being played. I heard airplanes overhead. They bombed essentially their White House, the presidential palace. There was a coup. Allende was killed, and the military government took over. My reaction to this was two. Democracy and liberty are amazingly fragile ideas. We take them for granted. We are raised in this country. You have freedom. You can wear what you want, say what you want, go where you want. One day, in my lifetime, I lived in a place where they went away. Overnight, gone. No Congress, no press freedom, no freedom of association, just gone. But what I want to talk about is the topic of today's panel, which is torture. I remember, I'm going to tell you a vignette about it, which puts it in context. About a week or two later, after the coup happened, again, there was martial law, talking about control of the authority structures. There was martial law. There was a curfew at night. We could hear gunfire at night. So people who tried to venture out, you would be shot. And if you saw the movie Missing, you go on Netflix and try to find that movie, it's a pretty good example of what those days were like after the coup happened. About a week or two later, my husband and I were invited to a friend's house for tea. That country has a very strong British tradition, very proper in some ways, and they have tea in the afternoon. So it was this weird feeling. We're in the middle of this military coup, and all these chaotic, violent things were happening around us, and yet these cultural patterns continued. We went to this lady's house. We began to hear, and this is kind of comical, I guess, in some ways, that women who were upset that their husbands were having affairs were turning their husbands' names into the secret police, saying they were communists, so that the husbands would be taken away. So that's the human interest aspect. But the deeper issue was, a woman came to this tea, dressed in an elegant suit, like a Chanel suit. She had white gloves on. A very elegant matron from Chilean upper class. And she was sipping tea, and people were very attentive to her. And she begins to tell the story that she had been detained, picked up, and tortured because they were looking for her son, who was a member of the Socialist Party. And as I was listening to her, I really did begin to contemplate this issue. This was a middle class country, Western traditions. Chile, like Mexico, Salvador, you know, the Latin traditions in South America, but certainly had a Congress, had a free press, had 12 daily newspapers. And I heard her story. I was obviously terrified myself to watch this story of torture. And I just heard the description of hearing screams and just the terror in her own heart. She did not know where her son was. But they did not know that. After we left that tea, I met with a man who we had known, middle-class businessman, and I was sharing with him, again, I was only 27, how I felt about hearing this and trying to make sense of this. This lady clearly was not a terrorist. She was not a fighter. She wasn't, you know, off to the brigades herself. And this man said to me, Jim, you need to understand these are unusual times. And in unusual times, you need to do unusual things. And I thought, this is middle class acceptance of torture. And I kept mulling over this question. Chile is a small country. I think maybe at the time, maybe 15 million people, about the size of California at the time. And I kept thinking, what makes a society move from democratic principles, institutions, to acceptance of this? This man was one of many that we knew in the middle class society of business owners and even academics. Because at that point, what happened is gay people were picked up and tortured. People who people thought were strange were picked up and put in a stadium. Once you get into this, and I think you're kind of referring to when you change the standards, and if you're motivated, my own observation of this, if you're motivated by fear, as a government, I'm talking now, a government inflicting torture on its own citizens.
Jack?
And I will leave you with that. As you reflect about this, as Americans, knowing that actually our experiment in this country is an experiment, what is that dynamic that makes a country that has not had a tradition of military government, not had a tradition of repression, go through this period and accept torture? So I'll leave it with that.
Thank you very much to both of our speakers. So remember, if you have a comment or a question, some index cards, just put your hands up and they'll come around. While we're waiting for that, I'll start these guys off. Those are brilliant comments, thank you. But I mean, let's be honest, we've all seen 24. And we know that sometimes torture is the only thing that stands between us and disaster. So come on. Admit, this is something that we need in our toolkit, right? And I believe our liberals can say what they want, but this is an effective, necessary tool.
I've got the bomb. I know where it's going to go off. What are you going to do?
I assume this question is you.
I guess so.
So we need that drama in our television shows. We need comedy in our television shows. In real life, what you find is that torture is not just ineffective, it's counterproductive. What torture does is it produces false and fabricated information. And it is with that information that flawed decisions are made. And I'm going to give you some real-world examples. So after 9/11, we were afraid. We were in fear. We were fear of other attacks. And there was an emir of an al-Qaeda training camp named Ibn Sheikh Alibi. Ibn Sheikh Alibi was the emir of the Kabul training camp for al-Qaeda. Ibn Sheikh Alibi was in Department of Defense custody in Afghanistan. Ibn Sheikh Alibi was an al-Qaeda terrorist that I wanted to bring to justice. Rather than allowing investigators to bring Ibn Sheikh Alibi to justice, Ibn Sheikh Alibi was brought to Egypt, a rural regime that uses torture to extract information from human beings. Utilizing the same justification, we're afraid, we need to protect our country, just as anyone who wants to use torture does. And Ibn Sheikh Alibi was tortured. Ibn Sheikh Alibi said there is high level contacts between al-Qaeda in Iraq. There was no such contacts. That information got back to the White House. President Bush, when he was trying to drum up support in the United States to go to war with Iraq, he went to Cincinnati, Ohio, and said, we have information from credible sources. There is al-Qaeda in Iraq. Colin Powell's Secretary of State went before the United Nations and said, we have high-level information. There's al-Qaeda in Iraq. After he was released, he was released from Egyptian custody, what Ibn Sheikh Alibi said was, I just said it's a pain stuff. Here's an al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, I went back to the Pentagon that said, I've been investigating al-Qaeda since the 90s. There's no al-Qaeda in Iraq. This doesn't make sense. It doesn't track with any information we've had over the years. My terrorist experience went back to the 90s with Sheikh Omar al-Rahman in New York, the first World Trade Center attack. We've been tracking this group for over a decade. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq. So we went to war based on fabricated information that was a product of torture. And we lost American lives and blood based on that fabricated information. So the problem with the analogy is it's not just ineffective, it's counterproductive. It corrupts any type of legitimate intelligence, and it taints any evidence. Now, you ask what happened to Ibn Sheikh Alibi, anybody wonder? The United States government transferred Ibn Sheikh Alibi to Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. He was visited by people from Human Rights Watch. Days later, it was reported that he committed suicide in his cell. Dead in hotels. That's why we did torture.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Actually,
all right, let's start watching the wire
instead. I missed something, Steve, sorry, in Saudi Arabia. I have to say, though, and you probably know the specifics of it, I do remember reading studies that they've done that when you apply a technique of really getting to know the prisoner, talking to the prisoner, establishing an emotional relationship, over time, haven't there been studies like this?
Yeah, I could speak.
I've read it in the press.
Yeah, so I can't hold a job for long, so I've had many different roles since I retired from the federal government. So in 2010, President Obama created what's called the High Value Detainee Interrogation Group. And this was a group comprised of people from the FBI, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the Department of Defense. And they formed, and what happened was President Obama, as soon as he became president, on the second day of office, issued an executive order that said, we will not torture, we will only use lawful techniques. But because they didn't use torture anymore. But if torture doesn't work, what does work? Because we need that information. We need to know how we can best extract that information so you don't blow up with your bomb. And so Since that time, and I was appointed to be on the, it's called the HAVE, the Higher Education Innovation Group Research Committee, and I had chaired that committee. And so what the HAVE research has done, and it's the first time in 50 years, one of the 50 years the United States government has sponsored any research into how to actually elicit actionable information from human beings. But there's been over 100 studies done. And what the 100 studies do is validate what the practitioners like me have said for years, rapport building techniques work. It's called rapport building techniques. So in spite of what you see on Hollywood about how interrogations are conducted, a nice guy like me is into a conversation. There is social science we use, social psychology. There are a lot of things we utilize to try to elicit accurate and reliable information, but it is based on rapport, and it is based on trust, and it is based on when we look at some of the things that social science does in the advertising industry. Advertisers manipulate you every day for a product. There's a doctor named Cialdini who did a great book, The Art of Persuasion. We teach interrogators, I teach interrogators, the art of persuasion. How to persuade you to give me information, the truth, and accurate. And so that's the techniques that we're using today. And as I said, there's been over 100 studies done. They all validate that rapport building, relationship-based techniques based on social science are very effective ways to elicit information, to build trust. And on the opposite end of the spectrum, coercion is not. Coercive techniques produce resistance. So the harder you push, the harder somebody pushes back. So those techniques actually are not very effective ways to actually do interrogations. And even to your point about Hollywood, West Point was very concerned with that because they were seeing cadets come to West Point thinking torture worked when we knew it didn't. And so the general provost from West Point went to Hollywood and said, will you guys please stop glorifying torture? Because you all are conditioned what an interrogation is because you've watched it on TV. I have been a known terrorist. I've done those interrogations. That's not how it works.
And there's a change the angle of a little bit that's approaching this from a rights perspective. So when innocence is not contested, the person is a proven terrorist who has killed before, and if free, will kill again. Why do they deserve rights? Retributionist theory of punishment is based on eye for an eye, so is torture not fair? And I'm thinking this is for you again, Lynn.
Well, if that's the case, where do you draw the line? Vehicular homicide, you're drunk driving the car, we torture you. We want your son, daughter, mother, father, tortured. We build our country on values. That's not what America does. We don't do that. And who's to say? I have seen so much fabricated information about who's a known or suspected terrorist. Just like I said, we went to war based on that information, and he was tortured based on that theory that you're talking about. He's a known terrorist, he's this, he's that. It's not effective. Now, I'm a guy who pledges allegiance to the Constitution of the United States, protect the small and foreign and domestic. So I'm not someone who will look to violate the principles of the 8th Amendment of the Constitution that prohibits not only torture, but cruelty. We signed treaties, the Convention Against Torture, by Ronald Reagan, to say we will not do these things, because we know it not only corrupts them, it corrupts us. I know people who have tortured. I know how they are tortured today by their acts. A piece of you dies when you do that to a human being. And so that's why I say don't do it.
And maybe mention the Stanford study. That's that. This.
Yeah, do you want to talk about these?
I don't remember all of it, and you can correct me.
Zimbardo.
But this is about you guys. Do you remember when this happened?
It was 50s? Phil Zimbardo, maybe in the 60s.
Anyway, he took college students at Stanford, so your age, basically. And he did a psychological experiment about what were the conditions and would you torture somebody, you. And his conclusion was, like, I don't remember all the details of it, is yes, you will. Yes, you will as a human being. If there's a social construct around you, an atmosphere around you that's encouraging it, it gives you some benefits for doing it, you think you won't, but you will. And those of you who are inside, you're going to study psychology, What's the name of it again?
Yeah, it's Phil Zimbardo. And what they found was, and there's a thing that's called psychological drift. I work with a lot of psychologists. And so what happens is you will go beyond those limits. So people hear about waterboarding and things like that. So even when, and we don't even work with our own service members anymore, and we only waterboard people in the Navy. And the people from the CIA waterboarded, they didn't even know how to do it, sorry. But anyway, what we found was that the SEER school, the search, survive, evade, resist, and escape, that's a school that our special forces and pilots and others go through. If they're captured, how to resist interrogations, how to resist providing information. And it was actually based on, I'll get back into the academic arena, it was actually based on a study of how our service members produced false and fabricated information when the North Koreans interrogated them. A guy named Albert Bitterman did a study in 1957 of that. Because we wanted to know, why are our military members producing false information? That was the same premise that we used when we inflicted our culture. It wasn't reverse engineers, we just applied those SEER techniques. So we knew that it produced false information, and we did it anyway. But even in those schools where military members are doing that in a role-playing exercise to military members, and they're only allowed to do it with 8 ounces of water for 20 seconds, with a safe word. But even in those cases, they have to have psychologists monitor it, because what happens is there's drift. They go beyond, and that's what happened in Stanford with Zimbardo's experience. They went beyond, and they became torturous. They stripped people naked, they lost. And he had to stop the experiment. Yeah, they have to stop the experiment after day, because that's what happens to human beings.
Right. My husband went to the Air Force Academy and was an F-15 pilot, and he did get this training. And he talked about this, that one of the benefits of this research, even when he was in school and doing the training, is that you used to tell all the military officers you're captured, you only give your name, rank, and serial number, and that they found that you will start talking. No one can resist this. And so the training for them was how to start talking about other things, just what you're saying. And so, you know, Jim flew the F-15 for 4 decades. But he never forgot those lessons he learned when he was down in Colorado Springs.
Can I add to that a little
bit?
Yeah, and even during World War II, the most famous and noted and successful interrogator for the Germans was a guy named Hans Scharf. Hans Scharf, he was with the Luftwaffe. And we actually teach what we call now the Scharf technique to our interrogators. And Hans Scharf, what he'd do is he'd just have a conversation with people. He'd sit them down, and we actually reviewed the logs of people, of American and others who were interrogated by him. And one of the nice things about the rapport approach and the Scharf technique is the person who's actually giving the information doesn't realize they're doing it.
Right.
So we read the logs, and he had a guest log, a guest book, and he would have them in the walks, and go out for walks and strolls, and he was the most successful interrogator, but the people, the Americans who we interrogated, didn't even realize they were giving up the information they were.
Very nice. Okay, so Janet, I'm going to take this one first. Jump into my part. As people who are involved in the government, what are some ways in which these situations can be prevented? How can individuals end them once they've started?
And I do want to stay on that little bit of the issue of human rights, because that's the other part of this topic. So the other country I lived in was Saudi Arabia. And honestly, living there maybe changed my thought about human rights, and also then applying to this question about how do you change practice. All the time I lived in Latin America, and I worked for a while for Amnesty International, because I was, you know, this torture stuff devastated me to see the acceptance of this. The model I grew up with was, and those of you who are involved in NGO activities or want to support, you know, good works, the model there is, the assumption is, in a country that has a dictator or an authoritarian moral person, Saddam Hussein type guy, a Pinochet dictator, that in those situations, we have organized in the international community to apply pressure on that person because the mass of the population is just dying for freedom. Once doesn't want to be tortured, obviously, wants human rights. We assume people want human rights. I assume this, right? People want human rights, you want to be free, and you only can't do it because of repression from the top. To me, that's a model. And when people write about it, they write about it just like I said. Amnesty does. When I got to Saudi Arabia, it forced me to rethink this, relook at it, because I realized the situation was much different than that. In the years we lived there, the king, King Abdullah, was an absolute monarch. No question about it. There was no democracy in that country. He was an absolute monarch. But on many different issues, women's issues, education, opening of society, he was much more progressive than the mass population. He was opening doors. He was building new colleges for women. He had a scholarship program. He opened an interfaith dialogue center in Vienna. But the population in Saudi Arabia, in this is true in Egypt, this is true in the world, very traditional, very much oriented to very, very conservative, rigid, traditional views of both Islam itself, their culture that they live in. And so when we had intervening situations, including Iraq, I would say, and we took away the authoritarian figure, and even at the time of the Bush administration, the assumption was you got rid of Saddam Hussein, and democracy would naturally flow to human desire, and it would naturally flow into the political sphere. And what we found was, obviously, we got rid of him, but chaos, antagonism, tribal conflicts, group conflicts, family conflicts rose up because after living in an authoritarian structure for so many years, no other political structures or political values had emerged that would deal with intergroup conflict. So it made me rethink, not that it made me against human rights, but made me realize we have to be much more attentive to the individual history and culture of every country before we analyze that situation. I see human rights. I grew up with this. In Saudi Arabia, the definition of rights, especially when it comes to a woman, is primarily, certainly initially, and primarily defined as economic rights. So when you talk to a Saudi about what are the rights of women in Saudi Arabia, they will begin with Islamic rights of inheritance, of controlling money in marriage, you keep your own name in marriage. They're primarily rights that relate to economics. So the idea of a woman driving or guardianship is defined as something else, as an issue about mixing and gender should not be together. It's evil, it's corrupt to have genders, boys and girls together. So that's defined differently. So just know that if you are interested in this area, to work here in an NGO or as somebody that calls you for your profession, keep in mind that it's really, really important to look at each individual setting for the question. Oh, and well, in terms of how to stop it, again, think about this. My argument about, in terms of the Middle East and the flood itself, when you look at torture being inflicted by ISIS, they burn people alive. That's torture. They're not trying to get information, but they're trying to make a statement of intimidation. Those types of profound questions, the infliction of pain, at heart, these have to be discussed among Muslims themselves from the region. This is their region, their religion, their children. And the profound question of how you treat each other, the use of force, the use of intimidation, the use of the threat of punishment. You know, in Islam, there's a deep focus, as there is in many religious traditions, on Day of Judgment. You better be, you know, maybe your mother's tried this out of you. You better be good, or hell awaits. Certainly in the 50s in the Catholic Church, that was a common thing. You better be good, or the Day of Judgment is going to happen, and you won't do well when you're judged. But these are human issues. What makes people want to do things, quote, in the right way? So stopping abuse takes an eternal discussion among the cultural groups.
Great. Following on that, work trip 2001-2008 to be prosecuted? If so, what hasn't that happened?
Yes. So here's what happens. We actually have obligations under the Convention Against Torture to actually, it's an international war crime. And there are member states, there's over 100, I forget the number off the top of my head, states who signed on to this. And the U.S. led the charge before this to say there's universal jurisdiction. And so what happened is, when President Obama took office, we had known even before the torture person, because the Senate Armed Service Committee under Carl Levin issued a report on detainee abuse, and it resulted in what's called the Detainee Treatment Act, which said that we learned a lesson. This serious stuff is tortured. Not only did murder was ineffective, and I talked to the Senate about the staff that was involved in that whole congressional hearing. And actually, when I saw these things gravitating from the CIA to the Department of Defense at Guantanamo Bay, I wrote, at the time it was a very famous policy statement to my staff that said, this is the kind of stuff congressional hearings are made of. And Carl let me know about those Senate hearings reading from that statement of mine, saying that exact fact. And so what happened was, people understood that we had an obligation, but President Obama said, we need to move forward, not backwards. And that, there was kind of an outcry, because whether people, and you say prosecuted, people should be held accountable. And some of that, I think there should be a public accounting about what actually happened. And when my book comes out, there will be. So what happened was, when President Obama said that, there was an outcry from the people in Congress who actually knew it. Senator Leahy, Senate Judiciary Committee, actually said, well, then hold, you know, we have to hold truth commissions. Because if we don't hold people accountable, we could go down this road again. And he said, just like they did down in South Africa, as long as people come in and admit to what they did, because we know we did. I know we did. And so that policy of impunity from President Obama has created the conditions where those that said this was necessary, safe, and effective were able to continue that narrative in retirement to protect their legacies. And so the narrative created to establish the program was able to continue for years in books and other things from these people until the Senate Intelligence Committee report, the torture report came out, actually exposed really the damage within the CIA that was done. The Senate Armed Service Committee was part of the DOD process. And so the problem with our inability to hold people accountable is twofold. One, it allowed Republican candidates running for president, including our current president, to actually advocate for the use of torture, a war crime. So President Trump campaigned actually on a war crimes platform. Plundering oil, taking oil is a war crime. Torture is a war crime. And so when he took office, he actually had drafted an executive order to go back to the bill. Let's let the CIA establish black sites, and let's let them take over again. And people within his own administration lead that intentionally, so that there would be Congress would get involved. And General Mattis got involved, who was the Secretary of Defense, and said, I'd be better with a pack of cigarettes and a six-pack or whatever. But what happens is that there are people that know, unfortunately there's too many people in his administration who are clueless of this. The other downside is, other than we could be down the slippery slope and torture again, even though it's illegal, and even though the legislation's been enacted even since then. In 2016, the McCain-Feinstein Anti-Torture Act was enacted, passed in the Defense Authorization Act of 2016, signed by Obama, basically trying to codify how illegal torture actually is. And yet still, those of us on the inside are concerned we could be down that slope again. The other part of this is there's universal jurisdiction. So senior personnel, including the former president of the United States, there are countries that he won't travel to. There are countries the Secretary of Defense won't travel to.
There is currently active investigations going on in France looking at the torture conducted by the Department of Defense at Guantanamo Bay on detainees there. They subpoenaed General Miller, the first commanding general of Guantanamo. They're looking at Jim Haynes, the Office of General Counsel, for Corps Secretary Rumsfeld. There's been cases in Germany. CIA case officers involved in the rendition of a person who was innocent in Italy and was rendered and tortured and released have been convicted in absentia of their crimes. So internationally, the cascading effect of that policy of impunity has allowed others to say, you can't tell us not to torture, look what you do. How do we tell them that they need to hold their people accountable when they torture us, we want to hold our people accountable when we torture them? So it's a problem we have now.
Okay, what
I just want to say one quick thing. You made reference to something. Just keep in this mind, in your mind if you go in this profession. The truth and reconciliation idea is, if a nation has gone through this experience, especially the torture of its own people like Chile faced, it's faced the question when democracy came back, and it did come back, they were woman president now. How do you go from having a shared experience? If you knew, let's say this part of the room torture, that part of the room. And then all of a sudden, people in the country, we have to live together. They came up with an idea. You can move on together as a country, a primarily women, it looks like to me, that the people who torture have to have a safe environment when they come together with those that they torture, torturers and torturers, and they say truth to each other. You say, I did this to you. And the other person says, basically, I forgive you. But without that process happening, it is difficult to resist the temptation for revenge. So after Tahrir Square happened in Egypt, when they opened the bar, I had actually talked to some Chilean friends saying, it would have been interesting if they could have gone to Egypt. Because Egypt did not do that. And the desire to get revenge continues to play on Egypt every single day. So that's what this idea is. Truth and reconciliation, they used it in South Africa. They've used it in other places that have started in the future.
Okay, well, thank you. So we're nearly out of time. I think we've heard some fascinating themes come through here. We've heard actually depth about the ineffectiveness of torture and some of the alternatives that you could use on your friends and stuff. We talked about the normalization of torture, how it can become the done thing, and it's actually pretty easy for people to shift over to that mindset. We keep that in mind since we live in, what was it, special times? We talk about how important cultural variations are, what people consider important. It's very difficult to assume that from the outside that everyone looks at the world exactly like we do. And then this question of impunity without accountability is a very, very slippery slope. I didn't hear an answer to the question about what can we do about it. That one seems beyond us.
It's
definitely something to keep talking about it and keep it in mind. And keep your eyes open.
Yeah, great.
Thank you very much.